This is Robert Conley at National Public Radio in Washington. The Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger, held a press conference today in Washington, a press conference that covered the Arab oil embargo, the Middle East peace, and mixed in with both the current energy crisis in the United States. In one of those quirks of government, the State Department would not permit live broadcasts of Dr. Kissinger's remarks. But the news conference is now over, so NPR will be bringing you a recorded version of that news conference in full in just a moment. This is Dr. Kissinger's first public forum since his return from a jet swing around the world, a swing that took him through the Middle East and Israel, then on to the People's Republic of China and Japan. The Middle East was the main focus on that trip, and it still is. Only last night, an aide of his, Under Secretary of State William Porter, warned the oil-producing countries of the Middle East that economic blackmail, meaning their oil embargo, will not work, that the embargo, in his words, is a two-edged sword that can hurt those who wield it as well as the intended victims. Given those factors, we go now to the State Department for the start of Dr. Kissinger's press conference, as recorded a short time ago.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'll just make a very few brief observations about where we stand in the Middle East, where we expect to go, then say a word about our attitude towards the various oil pressures. First, with respect to the situation in the Middle East. As I've pointed out before, our objective was to solidify the ceasefire so that we could move forward together with the other interested parties towards peace negotiations. Now, in the complex situation that exists on the Egyptian-Israeli front, sufficient progress has been made on the ceasefire, in the ceasefire negotiations, so that we can look forward with some confidence to the beginning of peace negotiations. Our effort will be to create the appropriate auspices called for in Security Council Resolution 338, and under the auspices of the United Nations, to begin a negotiating process, hopefully during the month of December, that we believe will, and that we expect and hope, will lead towards the just and lasting peace that all parties have pledged themselves to attempt to negotiate. The United States has committed itself in Security Council Resolution 338 to support the implementation of Security Council Resolution 242 in all of its parts. We will make a major effort to narrow the differences between the parties, to help the parties move towards the peace that all the peoples in the area need and that the peace of the world requires. Now, this will be our policy in the Middle East. We stated this policy to the Arab foreign ministers at the United Nations prior to the outbreak of the Arab-Israeli war. And I lay stress on this because the United States policy is determined not by the pressures that this or that nation may attempt to generate, but by the American conception of the national interest and of the interest of general peace. Now, the United States has full understanding for actions that may have been taken when the war was going on, by which the parties and their friends attempted to demonstrate how seriously they took the situation. But as the United States has committed itself to a peaceful process, as the United States has pledged that it would make major efforts to bring about the implementation of Security Council Resolution 242. Those countries who are engaging in economic pressures against the United States should consider whether it is appropriate to engage in such steps while peace negotiations are being prepared, and even more, while negotiations are being conducted. I would like to state for the United States government that our course will not be influenced by such pressures, that we have stated our policy, and that we've expressed our commitments, and that we will adhere to those and will not be pushed beyond this point by any pressure. Now, this is all I will say on the Middle East, but of course I'll be delighted to answer your questions. There's one matter that I wanted to raise with you, ladies and gentlemen, growing out of my last press conference, in which I promised within a week to supply the material on which the evidence on which our decision to have go on alert was based. It was a statement that, quite frankly, I regretted having made in terms of the short deadline immediately afterwards. The reason is that as we are now moving towards peace negotiations, which we expect to conduct with the cooperation of the Soviet Union, I do not believe any useful purpose would be served if the United States recited confidential communications that had taken place and try to recreate an episode of confrontation that hopefully has been transcended. As time goes on, and as the spirit of cooperation which we are attempting to foster in the Middle East takes hold, as things can be seen in fuller perspective, we still expect to fulfill what I have stated. I'm also glad to note that whatever the formal cooperation of the government, repertorial enterprise, and the reluctance of associates to admit anything less than full knowledge of participation in events have both combined to produce journalistic efforts that have given a fuller picture of events than those that were available on the morning of my last press conference. So with these two observations, I will turn to your question.
Mr. Secretary, in your exposition on the situation in the Middle East, you said the United States will not be influenced by the pressures. I assume you're talking economic or otherwise. And I wanted to ask you whether the opposite side of that coin has any validity. In other words, Mr. Vest, your spokesman, early this week ruled out any retaliatory economic measures against what he calls the Arab blackmail. I don't know whether he used the term blackmail. I shouldn't say that. But anyway, he ruled out retaliatory economic measures. Then, just last night, Undersecretary Porter, in a speech, indicated what some people thought was the possibility of economic retaliation by the United States when he said that this sort of thing was a two-edged sword. And then a number of eminent economists from your former neighborhood called upon the government to resist Arab blackmail and to take and to consider taking countermeasures. Now, that's a long question, but what I want to know is, are you going to slap back at me? The
principal objective in the Middle East now is to try to move the contestants towards a spirit of greater conciliation and towards a greater understanding that the requirements of world peace simply do not permit the constant warfare that has been characteristic of the past 20 years. We still hope that some of the steps that were taken when certain assumptions were made about the principal American objective in that area will be changed when it becomes apparent that we are attempting to bring about a just peace. However, it is clear that if pressures continue unreasonably and indefinitely, that then the United States will have to consider what countermeasures it may have to take. We would do this with enormous reluctance, and we are still hopeful that matters will not reach this point.
Mr. Secretary, during your talks in China, there appears to have been a speed-up in the normalization process. Would you say, please, what effect this may have on our relations in Southeast Asia, particularly Cambodia, and on our relations with the Republic of China and Taiwan?
Well, first, let me make a negative point. I have seen several stories to the effect that the United States, on my trip to China, attempted to bring about a full normalization of relations and failed. This is totally incorrect. With respect to our relations to the People's Republic of China, we have always placed primary emphasis on the substance of the communications and on the substance of the consultations rather than on the form in which it took place. On this trip, we brought about an expansion of the functions of the liaison officers, a continuation of the exchange programs, an expansion of trade, and a substantial expansion of the consultative processes. This was the maximum that we had set ourselves as a goal. With respect to future normalization, I think that there are certain indications in the communique which now remain to be explored as to the form that might take. With respect to the impact of normalization of relations or increased contacts between the People's Republic and the United States on Southeast Asia, it has always been understood that that process towards normalization would be aided by a general condition of stability and tranquility in Asia, and that both sides had an obligation to do their utmost to bring this about. So we are hopeful that the situation in Southeast Asia will not be exacerbated by the actions of any outside country. With respect to our relations, with respect to the situation in on Taiwan, there have been no changes in the basic relationship. Yes.
Are you committed not to release, to give, to by a promise to the Russians not to release their notes?
Has released any of the private exchanges between the Soviet leaders and the president, and it would therefore be a very serious matter if we suddenly began to do it on a selective basis.
Secretary, on the same point, sir, you have explained why you cannot or will not go any further on this issue. Can you not perhaps clarify some of the existing apparent discrepancies on the record? You said at your press conference that there were certain ambiguities as to what the Soviet intent was. The president said that this was the gravest crisis since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Could you possibly clarify that fundamental issue for us?
When I gave my press conference, I was motivated by the same considerations that I have expressed here. I saw no purpose at that time to stress the aspect of confrontation. The in any set of actions, unless the event which you're trying to prevent has in fact happened, there is always a certain element of uncertainty. We believed, on the basis of evidence of an intelligence nature, coupled with specific communications, that there was a serious danger that we attempted to avoid. The president described his judgment of the seriousness of the event had it occurred. The difference, perhaps, in characterization is due to the fact that I spoke before I was aware of the UN decision, and I attempted to influence a conciliatory attitude in the decisions that were to be taken.
You referred, or one of them, to which I assume you referred in your opening comment. It's stated and attributed to a cabinet official that during the in the course of the decisions on the alert, the president empowered you and Mr. Schlesinger to manage the crisis on your own, to conceive and carry out various moves, and the president himself only ratified those moves. Is that a correct characterization of his role?
I don't want to go into the details, but I thought also I made clear in my statement that not every official who comments to journalists is in equal possession of the facts.
In one of your answers before, you left open the possibility that the first option available to Arab leaders, which is the preferable one from your point of view, wouldn't occur until after peace negotiations had begun. We're talking about next month. We're talking about some movement in those peace negotiations. Implicitly, you're not holding out any hope for an end to the embargo until the beginning of the year. Is that fair?
No, I don't want to set a deadline to decisions that are not of our own making. I would have thought that the most constructive course would be to give the negotiating process a chance now that the point has been made, and to permit the countries concerned to make their efforts. What the appropriate timing for that decision is, I think, should be left in the first instance to the leaders who have to make that decision. I didn't want to give a deadline. Marvin?
Can you tell us how you envisage this peace conference? On the Israeli side, there is one state. On the Arab side, several. Is a veto to be implied? How do you see this developing?
Well, of course, the conference, to be effective, would have to be left to a considerable extent to the decision of the participants. It could, for example, there are many ways it could be conducted. It could operate through plenary sessions that then break up into a series of bilateral negotiations. It could address some issues of common concern in plenary sessions and then some issues of bilateral concerns in separate meetings. I think the possibilities for the procedural possibilities are fairly wide and should be explored in the first instance by the parties concerned. Obviously, no agreement can be made, and certainly no agreement can last unless it has the willing participation and agreement of all of the parties at the conference. Les?
Secretary, is it your understanding of the modified Cooper-Cherry legislation regarding deterrence that it prohibits all direct U.S. military activity, land, sea, and air, with respect to North Vietnam, South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia?
That has been my understanding of it, yes.
Mr. Secretary,
some Israeli troops today in the Sinai said that the U.S. will put pressure on Israel to make some concessions. Could you now elaborate on what concessions you would expect Israel to make?
What the United States will do will depend on the process of negotiations. It is obvious that the conditions that produced the war that started on October 6 will have to be changed. And it is obvious, and it has always been understood, that a peace settlement will not ratify the ceasefire lines as they existed on October 6. Therefore, a peace settlement will have to have a number of elements. It will have to have an element of withdrawals. It will have to have an element of security arrangements between the parties concerned, and it may have to have an element of outside guarantees. In addition, there are such issues as the Palestinians and the future of Jerusalem that will undoubtedly have to be discussed in some form or another at a peace conference. We hope that Israel, as well as the Arab countries, will recognize that one of the clear consequences of recent events is that a purely military solution to the problems of the Middle East is impossible, and that all countries therefore have the problem of the right balance between their security needs and the needs of legitimacy, acceptance, or whatever you want to call it. We do not consider it axiomatic that this can only be achieved by pressure on Israel by the United States to make concessions. We expect to have full consultations with Israel, as we expect to have discussions with the Arab participants. And the positions we will take as the negotiations develop depend on the positions the various parties take during the course of the negotiations and cannot be assumed ahead of time.
What role do you foresee for the Palestinians at the peace conference?
This is a very difficult question that affects Israel, the other Arab states, and among the other Arab states, Jordan in particular. And it is a question which sometime in the course of the negotiation will require explicit discussion. Whether it is necessary to address it in the very first phases of the negotiations, when probably the military issues will loom largest, remains to be seen, and I would doubt. But the Palestinian issue is, of course, one of the key questions that will come up.
In your discussions yesterday with the American representatives of American oil companies, were you at all encouraged that these oil companies would take the effort, the American effort to produce a peace settlement in the Middle East, into consideration, particularly with emphasis on Japan, on the supply of oil to American troops stationed on Okinawa in Japan, and will they provide some of the scarce reserves that they have to help the Japanese particularly?
Now, the problem of the worldwide energy crisis has been a very profound challenge to all of the oil-consuming countries. At a minimum, we have an obligation to study seriously what we can do to alleviate difficulties that have been caused either by policies which we consider responsible during the war, which would be the case with the Netherlands, or which are produced by the stationing of American troops, which would be the case in Japan. We are now looking at this problem very seriously and hope to formulate some position by the early part or by the middle part of next week. The meeting with the oil executives was not primarily concerned with these more or less technical issues. It was rather concerned with the fact that here are representatives of the United States that are operating in many of these countries, or representative of American companies that are operating in many of these countries and that need to understand what the basic direction of our policy is, so that in their own economic activities they are at least aware of how we conceive the national interest.
By your new policy is virtually zero, suggests that the communication was so bad that you had to call a military alert to get your message across.
I didn't understand the question.
What I'm trying to ask is whether or not, or exactly what role President Nixon's personal relationship with Mr. Brezhnev played in the recent alert.
The relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States is an inherently ambiguous one. We have never said that detente indicates that we have parallel objectives or that it indicates that we have compatible domestic structures. Our view has been that the detente is made necessary because it's the two great nuclear superpowers. We have a special responsibility to spare mankind the dangers of a nuclear holocaust. And if one looks at history and sees how often it has happened that wars have been produced by the rivalries of client states without a full consideration of the worldwide issues, how easily misunderstandings could produce confrontations that could have catastrophic consequences, the overriding need of finding a solution to the problem of worldwide general nuclear war becomes overwhelming. As I pointed out in my last press conference, this is the central problem of our period, and it is a problem that will have to be solved either by this group of officials or by their successors. But it cannot be avoided. Now, in this situation, in this relationship, one will always have an element both of confidence and of competition coexisting in a somewhat ambivalent manner. The relationship that has developed between the Soviet Union and the United States since 1971 has been one of considerable restraint, and there have been very frequent, very confidential exchanges between General Secretary Brezhnev and the President. At the same time, it is perfectly conceivable, and indeed it has happened during the Middle East crisis, that long-standing commitments, ideological pressures, produce actions that bring these two sides into confrontation. At that point, it is important that enough confidence exists so that the confrontation is mitigated. And therefore, one has to judge not only the fact that a confrontation occurred really in the aftermath of a settlement and as a result of actions which could not be fully controlled by either of the two sides, because it happened, the immediate cause was the violation of the ceasefire, but one also has to consider how rapidly the confrontation was ended and how quickly the two sides have attempted to move back and are now moving back to a policy of cooperation in settling the Middle East conflict. And I would therefore say that the relationship that had developed between the two governments and between the two leaders played a role in settling the crisis, even though it had not yet been firm enough to prevent the crisis.
Played a role is one thing, but what kind of a role was that in this particular instance?
I have tried to give my best. It played, in my judgment, a significant role, the degree of which one will have to assess over a period of time.
You have referred several times to peace negotiations within the next several weeks, yet Prime Minister Meir has said this is impossible until after the Israeli election December 31st. Do you have assurances from the parties concerned of a place and a date and which parties will participate, and may we know them?
We have no absolutely firm assurances, but we have some rather substantial understandings with all of the parties of the time frame which I indicated. The participants remain fully to be determined, but we are close to an agreement on that as well. And we will also agree then on the site. We hope that this process should be completed during the next week, and we will then announce it as soon as all the parties have agreed to it. I'm trying to understand this process where I look at one person and another one speak, but ladies first. Go ahead, Marilyn.
You said the United States produces 85% of its energy, and it has been noted that other countries are not that fortunate. Is the United States, among the things it is considering, thinking of sharing some of its energy sources with Japan and the Netherlands and other countries less fortunate at a time of embargo?
Well, our first problem is to understand exactly what needs to be done to get our own energy crisis under control. And I'm told that energetic steps in that direction are being taken. The degree to which we can share our energy sources with other countries is a very complex matter. And of course, the more broadly the sharing is conceived, the more difficult it becomes. But with respect to specific needs, such as in the case of the Netherlands and the particular issue that Mr. Wallach mentioned in the case of Japan, require our careful study, and we're trying very hard to look into it. The second issue that is raised by your question is the attitude that the more vulnerable countries should take in this crisis, with all understanding for their vulnerability. And they have to consider whether by taking isolated actions they will contribute more to the peace settlement, on which, after all, the ultimate solution of this problem depends, or whether their better course would not be to try to work as closely with us in the responsible efforts that we are trying to undertake.
Information hearings, you said that the United Nations could not or would not be able to play a useful political role because of the veto that the superpowers or the major powers have in the Security Council. In the event, during this Middle East crisis, it looks as if the United Nations was able to play a useful role. First, have you changed your opinion? And second, what does this forecast for the United States' use of the UN in the future?
I must say that the United Nations played a more effective role in this crisis than could have been deduced from my theoretical statements as a professor or from my statements during my confirmation hearings. It proved to be an extremely effective sounding board, the most rapid means of communication among the parties, and when the chief participants had decided on a settlement, the most effective way by which the settlement could be achieved. Finally, it performed the absolutely essential role of providing the buffer that prevented the confrontation that could have occurred without it. So we believe that the United Nations played a very useful role, and we will take very serious account of that in the solution of other problems. There was somebody who had... Yes.
In view of the evident and considerable strategic advantage to Russia inherent in the reopening of the Suez Canal, granting their large Mediterranean fleet access to the Indian Ocean, to the Persian Gulf, and so on, can you tell us why, if, as I think is the case, the United States
so strongly favors the reopening of the Suez?
The United States has not favored the reopening of the Suez Canal in the abstract. The United States has favored an evolution of the Middle East policy of such a nature that some reasonable prospect towards a final settlement was opened up to the chief participants. If anything has become clear in recent years, it is that the situation as it existed prior to October 6 was simply unacceptable to enough of the Arab countries in the Middle East, so that it would constantly produce the danger of renewed warfare and of a kind of warfare that, as the war has made clear, is not in the long-term interest of Israel either. Therefore, the opening of the Suez Canal ought to be seen not in the context of the strategic movements of the Soviet fleet, but in the context of world peace in general. Now, with respect to the movement, to the greater ease of movement of the Soviet fleet from the Mediterranean into the Indian Ocean, there's a great danger of looking at developments in this area in terms of a strategy that is more appropriate to the previous century than to this. Soviet influence in the Indian Ocean will not depend primarily on the number of ships it can deploy into the Indian Ocean. And I'm confident that to the degree that power becomes the principal factor in the Indian Ocean, that we will be able to generate a fleet of sufficient size in that area so that we could counterbalance anything that the Soviet Union might put into the Indian Ocean, as the recent visit of the Hancock in that area has demonstrated.
Are you favoring a permanent U.S. Indian Ocean fleet, or inferring that?
I am stating that the future of the Middle East should not be deduced from the steaming time of the Soviet fleet from the Black Sea into the Indian Ocean, and whether adding 10 days to it or cutting 10 days off it will not be the determining factor. Therefore, the United States' attitude towards the opening of the Suez Canal and to the military disengagement of forces in that area will be determined primarily, first, by the contribution this would make towards the general peace in the area, and secondly, by the possibilities it gives to reduce the influence of outside powers in general by focusing matters on Middle East concerns. That is the principal issue, and this is the best way to reduce Soviet influence, and for that matter, any outside influence in that area. Bernie?
In your opening statement, you referred to the peace talks under UN auspices. I think at your last press conference you talked about Soviet-American auspices. Is this a slight change? And secondly, after your appearance before the Foreign Relations Committee yesterday, you said you had no plan but certain principles that you would like to see in an agreement. Chairman Fulbright, in his talk with newsmen yesterday, went through certain principles, including which he said he favored the Rogers plan of Israeli pullbacks to the old boundaries with insubstantial changes. I wondered how you felt on that question.
With respect to the procedural issue, we still believe that the appropriate auspices foreseen in Security Council Resolution 338 could best be provided by the United States and the Soviet Union. We believe, however, also that these auspices should be generally blessed by the United Nations, and we would have no objection, in fact, we would welcome some participation by the Secretary General of the United Nations to symbolize this United Nations aegis. With respect to the specifics of an American position, our attitude, I have stated the general principles with respect to Security Council Resolution 242 and some of the elements that we believe are likely to be contained in such a negotiation. We do not believe it is effective for the United States to put forward a proposal in all its details, which then will enable both parties, or will tempt both parties, to start shooting at the American proposal rather than to concentrate on what it is that they should accomplish. We believe that the process that was followed in bringing about the six-point agreement solidifying the ceasefire may be more effective, in which the parties assume responsibility for their own positions. And once they've put their positions on the table, then the United States can attempt to bring about a closing of the gap and perhaps inject its own ideas where those appear to be useful.
NATO proved to be a rather fragile vessel at the height of our airlift, Mr. Secretary, and some hard words were exchanged openly and privately. Would you give us your estimate of the damage that's been done to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization and what can be done to shore it up, if anything?
Well, let me say, first of all, that the relationships in the Atlantic area remain the absolutely core element of American foreign policy. We remain convinced, as we have been convinced on a bipartisan basis in the entire post-war period, that if the free nations of the North Atlantic cannot regulate their relationships with each other, it is hard to see how they can cope with the problems on a global basis that they confront. On the other hand, it is necessary to realize that serious difficulties arose in recent weeks. These difficulties were not accidental, but have reflected strains that have been apparent for a good part of this year. Now, I have read a great deal of speculation which ascribes this to inadequate consultation by the United States. And, of course, senior officials have a tendency towards a conviction in their infallibility, and they rarely admit that mistakes might have been made. But I don't even want to argue that point. Any process of consultation can be improved. The key question one has to ask oneself, however, is, and that one has to answer, is this. It is a root fact of the situation that the countries that were most consulted proved among the most difficult in their cooperation. And those countries that were most cooperative were least consulted. So that there is at least no automatic relationship between consultation and agreement. Secondly, if we deal with the question in its deepest aspect, are the objections that were raised due to inadequate information or to a different perception of their role? And one cannot avoid the perhaps melancholy conclusion that some of our European allies saw their interests so different from those of the United States that they were prepared to break ranks with the United States on a matter of very grave international consequence. And that we happen to believe was of very profound consequence to them as well. Now, I don't want to debate the merits of this issue. And in answering your question, what damage has been done to the Atlantic Alliance, I would say the recent weeks made evident the need, which the United States tried to underline by its initiative for these declarations, of defining just what it is that the nations of the North Atlantic can do together and what they should do separately, of defining what forms of consultation are appropriate, how the nations of the North Atlantic can cooperate. This is what we put before the Europeans in April. This is what we hope to achieve. And this is what the need for it should have been made evident to both sides of the Atlantic in recent weeks. And if that is the conclusion that is drawn on both sides of the Atlantic, as it is on this side of the Atlantic, then I think it will have been a good thing, and it can lead to a new period of progress.
Mr. Secretary.
Well, we are having a NATO ministerial meeting on December 10th and 11th. And this gives an opportunity for the foreign ministers of all NATO nations to discuss the state of the alliance. We expect to do this candidly and in a constructive attitude and with the determination to put new vitality into Atlantic relationships.
The documents on the U.S.-Soviet situation, particularly, was it the American domestic turbulence at that time that encouraged you, particularly with that short deadline that you gave?
It's a mistake to assume that everything that is said in a press conference is fully considered.
To ask the Congress for the full $2.2 billion in aid to Israel, and has the United States committed itself to delivering that full total in armaments to Israel?
We maintain our request, and we will judge what will be done with it on the basis of the needs as they will be jointly assessed between Israel and the United States.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary.
The Secretary of State, Dr. Henry Kissinger, at a press conference recorded earlier today at the State Department, a press conference in which the Middle East and the Arab oil boycott played a large part, both of them being intertwined. Mr. Kissinger was particularly firm on the matter of the Arab oil boycott, picking up a theme that other State Department officials have been beginning to enunciate this week. And that is that the boycott itself could be a two-edged sword, hurting the Arabs as much as the United States. That boycott having been put in retaliation for Washington's support of Israel during the latest Middle East fighting. Dr. Kissinger left open the impression that the United States could be pushed, but pushed only so far, and that in no way would it ever respond to pressure. On the other point, the matter of a Middle East peace conference, Dr. Kissinger was particularly hopeful, saying that he hoped that there would be some talk between the Arabs and the Israelis this month, possibly within the matter of a few weeks, but that estimate was greeted by some skepticism by the reporters questioning him. Funds for this special broadcast came from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From Washington, this is Robert Conley, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.